Hi, OTM podcast subscribers. This here is a little something extra for you. It's an extended version of an interview I did with Armando Iannucci for last week's show, which was all about the nexus of politics and journalism in the nation's capital. Iannucci is the creator of HBO's hit comedy Veep, often regarded as the most realistic portrayal of Washington, D.C. on television today. This interview, like the show itself, is positively laced with obscenity. You have been warned. I want to begin this with a criticism. It's my only one of your television program. Every character is you. They all have exactly the same insult humor, excepting Tony Hale. They're hilarious, lashing, withering insult humor, but they're all equally good at it, and they all have the filthiest mouths on television, which is equally delightful.
Why this fucking internet is sketchier than our economic forecasts?
Oh, that's because your laptop is still running on Windows 2000 and shit.
Dan, we need to break this Cassie bitch, the British dick who invented the internet, and anybody in between.
He knows I've got a bigger role in the White House now, which means I've got a bigger dick, which means he can suck it.
It's fucking insane here. It's like a math prison. They rape you with numbers.
Why are we talking about noodles?
No, let me rephrase that. Why the fuck are we talking about noodles?
This is all Cliff's fault. That grinning fucking Ewok. They're all in the Situation Room. I'm stuck here swearing in a shitload of senators.
Yeah, you say they're all me, but I very rarely swear, and I seldom insult people. I tend to get on with people rather well. It makes for a more productive working environment when you actually get on with people.
So are you channeling this from some deep and dark place?
Do you know, I don't know where it comes. And the other writers who work on this show, if you speak to the cast, they'll say they're the meekest, mildest Englishman imaginable. And because I'm Scottish, people seem to imagine, therefore, that all the anger and the aggression and the rage comes from me, and are then surprised when I open my mouth and out comes a very un-Scottish accent. I don't know where it comes from. I mean, ask any writer, really, people who write macabre murder stories, where it comes from. It just comes from somewhere in the recesses of your mind, or it comes from things that you've observed, really. This, you know, the show, even though it's a comedy, is a kind of reaction to the world of politics, as well as being about politics. It's perhaps my angry and frustrated response to what I see around me in the real world of politics.
Why do you suppose that Washington has suddenly become the default venue for television drama and comedy? What's so great about Washington all of a sudden?
You say great, perhaps because it's not great that we're drawn towards it. There is a certain amount of frustration. People feel detached from the political conversation. When there are great swellings of support, for example, for issues like gun control, and then nothing happens, or when invasions of other countries happen that no one was consulted on, or shutdowns happen despite all the best brains in Washington saying that they're contriving to come up with a deal, I think people feel frustrated. They feel that they're not being heard. And this cuts across, right across the political spectrum. Republicans and Democrats and independents all feel that they're not part of the conversation that's going on inside D.C. And therefore you have a vacuum. In the news and in current affairs, there is a vacuum because, you know, politics isn't progressing. And in that vacuum, you know, come idiots like me and comedians and dramatists and turn it into entertainment. It's our attempt to try and make some kind of sense over what we see is happening on the national political stage. Sense or nonsense.
In some ways, Veep is quite broad and verging on absurd, but it's actually quite detailed in the policy debates and has an unusual grasp over the atmospherics of Washington politics. And yet you are a foreigner with strange foreign ideas. How did you get your arms around Washington, D.C. politics so well and so quickly?
Well, I am a bit of a political nerd, and I've always followed politics from a very young age. You know, when others, when they were 13, 14 in the UK, followed football, and the US followed like baseball, scores and, you know, could ream off all the statistics. I was able to tell you who won which election and by how much a majority. And especially American politics, I'm interested in how American government works. And therefore, that's what I want this show to be about. I want it to be about the process. I don't want it to be about party politics, which is why we haven't made her a Democrat or a Republican. I want the comedy to come from how policy is made or isn't made, or how opinions are changed, or how compromises are made. It's all about that, really. And then, you know, I've spent a lot of time in DC talking to people who work in these buildings. And I say to them, I'm not out to expose anyone. I'm not out to talk about a scandal. I really want to know the dull detail. What time do you get in the morning? What's your office look like? What sort of people do you work with? And as you talk to these people, an image builds up of how a typical day in Washington works. And the revelation is that behind these big, grand edifices built like Roman imperial temples on the outside, inside those buildings are just hordes and hordes of people struggling to get through the day and kind of making it up as they go along because no one's quite had the time to explain things to them. That's where you discover that, you know, the country is being run by very, very young people who are very stressed.
A limestone Potemkin village you've just described.
Well, I went around various public buildings, and because it's wrong to spend any money on federal buildings, people don't like that. When you go inside, you realise how decrepit and falling apart these places are. The West Wing is just a warren of tiny, tiny rooms. And in the State Department, they couldn't afford to buy chairs that matched the tables and the desks. So they got chairs that are actually too high for the desk, so you can't pull the chair in under the desk. You can't sit comfortably. And in the West Wing, there are too many chairs for each table because everyone wants to say they work in the West Wing. So they cram as many people as possible into these tiny rooms. So a table that is room enough for three or four computer monitors actually has seven or eight of them on, and people crammed up. And very, very respectable, powerful-looking middle-aged men in suits sitting rumpled up on spare sofas and seats in corridors because there isn't a desk for them. They'd rather spend all day there just to go home and say, I work in the West Wing.
You have the staff of the Vice President of the United States crammed into these tiny quarters where desk real estate is at a premium. It looks kind of like steerage on the Lusitania. Not quite the grand digs that you have come to expect watching Hollywood films for the last, whatever it is, 50
years.
Yeah,
yeah, yes. And everyone wants to say that they work in the West Wing. The character of Jonah is really based on someone we met who worked deep in the bowels of the West Wing. I mean, it was so in the bowels, it was part of a cave network for another state, really, by the time that you found his office. But he said, you know, he just loves saying, he said actually, when you phone someone and say, I'm calling from the White House, you can hear the person on the end of the line holding the phone up to everyone else in the room and whispering and mouthing to all their colleagues, it's someone from the White House. I've got someone from the White House on the other end of the line. And he said he just got a real buzz knowing that that was happening every time he phoned. So why wouldn't you want to work there?
This character, Jonah, he's in his 20s. He is pompous and kind of clueless about the image he projects.
Hey, it's the flunkies. And people say you're bad at your jobs.
You here to spy, Jonah?
I'm not here to spy. I work at the White House, so I can just walk in and say, I'm from the White House. What the fuck are you doing?
What? You work at the White House? Oh, my God, can I blow you?
Yes, you can. I will meet you out in the hallway in
a few seconds. I'll get a stepladder.
Anyway, I work for the White House. What the fuck are you doing?
He actually answers his phone. Well, here's how he answers his phone.
White House, this is Jonah.
Just delicious character.
And people in Washington, they all say to me they know a Jonah. You do get other people in Washington saying, oh, I'm the Amy in the office or I'm the Dan in the office, but I know a Jonah. Somewhere there is a tomb to the unknown Jonah, somewhere in D.C.
Again, you're a bunch of foreigners, and it amazes me how you have grasped the pathologies of our system.
It's just revenge for you giving us Meryl Streep as Margaret Thatcher.
Well, first you gave the world Margaret Thatcher, so, you know, we all have our crosses to bear.
Absolutely.
Now, you have asserted that the vice president is not either Democrat or Republican. However, her pet political projects are very much associated with Democrats. Filibuster reform, clean jobs.
And also she would say she was hawkish in terms of the military. And we'll see her have centrist or right of centrist views on budget control and on crime. I think it's important that we believe her either to be, I'd say, a right-wing Democrat or a progressive Republican, so that she could be the vice president that Obama could have, but also conceivably the vice president that say, Mitt Romney would have chosen. I think in the first couple of seasons, we didn't want to project the show as coming from a particular point in the political spectrum.
The central joke of the first season is the obvious one. She's the vice president, completely marginalized, frequently humiliated, and at one point humiliated to the point that the president takes her off of clean jobs and puts her on the obesity task force.
Yeah.
Which is in that vortex of irrelevance that vice presidents and first ladies, you know, tend to share.
POTUS is anxious after recent events that you don't feel he's trying to nudge you out of the process of government.
Oh, isn't that thoughtful, Amy?
So he would like you to head up a program that is very important and very dear
no.
to his heart.
No, 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 no. You do not do this to me. Do not say that it is obesity. Do not say that to me.
It's obesity.
No.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but you have drawn the fat straw.
How did you know to put her on obesity?
She's come from the Senate as well. She was a powerful senator. And I just like the idea of these powerful, formerly influential politicians having to suddenly, you know, run a kindergarten or its equivalent, you know, having to deal with very small issues. It's like Lyndon Johnson was, you know, master of the Senate, was the Senate majority leader, got lots of reform and legislation through. And then when he became Kennedy's vice president, his big thing was NASA. That was it. It was spaceships.
There's a moment, I believe it's in the latter part of the first season, where the vice president finds herself presiding over the Senate as the tiebreaker vote.
Yes.
And is obliged in this situation to vote against a pet policy of her own.
That's right.
In order to support the president. And not only does she vote against it, but one of her aides had, through Machiavellian means, gotten this vote to the stage where she could have her way. And then in the end, she squandered the opportunity or heroically protected the administration. Mm. It's not clear, but it's heartbreaking.
I tell you what was heartbreaking. It was when Al Gore was president of the Senate, and he had to preside over the actual Electoral College vote that he had disputed with George W. Bush. So he had to preside over the vote that denied him the presidency. That must have been a horrible moment for him to go through that. Just when you want to, you'd think after the election itself, you'd want to just lock yourself away and never go near Washington again. But because he was still the sitting vice president, he had to preside over the formal vote that voted George Bush in.
It's situations like that that make you wonder what the definition is of dignity.
Exactly, exactly. And the other thing, of course, is, you know, America is very much a society based on achievement, opportunity, winning, coming first, excellence. So to spend your career with a button on your lapel saying number two is not dignified. A former chief of staff for a vice president told me when a vice president is in the room dealing with lots of people, he knows that quietly they're all laughing at him. But they can only laugh quietly because he might become president. And it's that double knowledge, the kind of humiliation and yet the, oh, what if I'm so close, that keeps them going, I think.
And tell me about the press in this ecosystem. You seem to have spared them substantially from some of the ridicule that you bring to other parts of the process.
Yeah, I'm kind of saving them. There is a bit more of it in season three, but I think season four, I think we'll see a little bit more about how the media works. That's an area that I think is still ripe for exploration. In season three, Jonah does leave the White House and become a blogger. So we see a bit more of the of how that whole world operates.
Tell me about the Eye of Sauron.
Well, the Eye of Sauron is the mainstay of Lord of the Rings. It's the all-powerful seeing eye that brings darkness from Mordor to Middle-earth.
Are you familiar with the Eye of Sauron? Fire-rimmed, all-seeing eye from Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
I think I caught it on a plane once.
The Eye of Sauron is the near-perfect analog for the modern media. If we can draw the eye to Helsinki, then it won't be looking at what's going on here.
And what is exactly going on here?
I cannot tell you that, Mike.
Is Selena Gollum?
Kent compares the media to the Eye of Sauron in that if it can be distracted away from a potentially damaging story, in this case it was something to do with the spy scandal in the White House and the president being caught in a lie, if we could distract the Eye of Sauron, like they do in the finale of Lord of the Rings, by releasing another story, this time one embarrassing to the vice president, that will take the Eye of Sauron away from Washington. Even though the plots are plots that we make up, one of the most frightening responses I've had from people in DC is when an episode has gone out and it's been one about an issue that we completely made up. We thought this was a good farcical plot line. And then somebody comes up and says, how on earth did you find that out? We thought we'd kept that quiet. And then you realise that we're unintentionally mimicking what goes on in Washington.
So it's not Law and Order torn from the headlines, but sometimes it feels that way.
Yes, it's not a topical show, but for example, in the very first episode of season 3, Jonah gets fired from the West Wing for writing, under a pseudonym, writing a blog, a kind of gossip blog about goings-on in the White House. Now, actually, some of our consultants in D.C. said to us, oh, you've got to take that out. That would never happen. Never in a million years would that happen. The very next day, someone got fired from the White House for writing an anonymous Twitter feed about gossip and what was going on in the White House. So all I can do is hold my hands up in despair and just say, see, told you.
Have you gotten any criticism for stuff you've just gotten completely wrong? Oh, no. Come on, Armando, no. I can see how you might have thought that, but no, you have this all wrong.
Well, people will say, well, technically, the vice president has a staff of 150, so it wouldn't be the same four or five characters with her all the time. To which you say, yes, I know that, but a show in which we feature on a weekly basis 150 characters is never going to work. You know, so you do have to, at various stages, say, look, there is a bit of comedic license allowed here. We have to boil down that reality into components that are very easily digestible. Because, yes, and the bulk of any vice president's time would be sitting by a desk, writing things down and signing things. And again, that's not going to be entertaining, is it?
One quick follow-up question. What is the essence of Washington?
Well, the essence of Washington, it seems to me to be the same 300 or 400 people taking turns at acting as if they know what they're doing.
Armando, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I spoke with Veep creator and executive producer Armando Iannucci for a special hour of On the Media about Washington, D.C. That show has more about Hollywood on the Potomac, as well as an exploration of who is setting the news agenda in the Capitol, the blurring lines between politicians, lobbyists, and the media, and me asking Wolf Blitzer,
you look lovely as always, Wolf. Who are you wearing?
Armani.
Well done. What's the what story are you chasing tonight?
I'm not chasing anything. We're here to have fun.
To hear the whole episode, and you so should, go to onthemedia.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.